Well, good morning. Welcome to the session on Welcome to the session on linking soil enzyme activities to ecosystem function. In this symposium, we have invited 10 outstanding speakers with two focused subjects. The session in the morning will be focused on ecology of soil enzymes. The session in the afternoon will be focused on enzyme activities in soil organic matter degradation and their responses to management practices. There will be a discussion session following the first session. So for those of you who have questions that want to discuss with speakers, if you don't have time to do so immediately after talk, you're welcome to stay to participate in the discussion. And if you have more questions with the speakers, you can stay even longer and have one-to-one discussion later on. So with that, we're going to start with the first session on ecology of soil enzymes and with first speaker, Matt Wallensentin. Did I spell it right? with the title Recent Advancement in Understanding the Ecology of Soil Extracellular Enzymes.
Well, thanks. Thanks to the organizers. I think it's really exciting to start off the soils meeting with a whole session on enzymes. So enzymes are incredibly important, but yet I think somewhat neglected given their importance. I mean, really, we wouldn't be here if it weren't for enzymes. And I don't mean here in this room, but in the grand sense of things, because without enzymes, decomposition would slow to just the slowest possible trickle. Of course, humans have enzymes in them, so we wouldn't be able to utilize our food. So enzymes have such a critical role, yet a lot of people don't think about them very much. One aspect of enzymes that's particularly important is their role in degrading soil organic matter. So enzymes are actually the agents that break down soil organic matter into the small molecules that can be assimilated by soil organisms. So without that enzymatic action, they wouldn't actually be able to utilize those larger molecules. And there's an important feedback between the ability of the microbial biomass to take up those products of enzymatic degradation and their ability to produce new enzymes. So there's this kind of feedback loop between the size of the microbial biomass and the amount of enzymes in the soil. But yet, if we look at a typical terrestrial biogeochemical model, enzymes are not explicit in that model. Instead, what we see is that the microbial biomass kind of acts directly on organic matter pools. So there's no enzymes. So if we think about what that implies, both about the way people think about these, about biogeochemistry, decomposition, and the way it's modeled, it implies that either the microbial biomass is sort of in some equilibrium with enzymes, or that enzymes are not the limiting factor in decomposition. So I think there's some important assumptions in the way people think about decomposition that we need to address. So I see several kind of key questions in soil enzymology that people have been grappling with for decades now, and that we continue to address using new tools and new approaches. The first one is, what factors determine the production of enzymes by plants and microbes? And of course, we can use new genomic tools, proteomic tools that are emerging to try to understand the factors that regulate enzymatic production. The second question is, what is the turnover time of enzymes after they are released into the soil? So enzymes are produced by microbes, but as soon as they're released, they're attacked by proteases and other things that degrade those enzymes. So how quickly are they turned over? What's the return on investment for enzyme production? The third question is, how much activity is maintained by stabilized enzymes? So at any time, out of the total amount of enzymes in the soil, a large proportion of them are stabilized. And we don't really know that much about how much activity is maintained by these enzymes? Are there active sites exposed? And then finally, who produces different types of enzymes? And this is a key question when we're trying to link changes in community composition of soil organisms to processes. So which microbes and plants are responsible for producing specific enzymes under different conditions? So let's think about how we generally approach these problems and how we interpret the data that we collect. So generally, we'll go out and we'll measure enzyme activities using lab assays, and we'll follow patterns in enzyme activities across spatial gradients, across time, or in response to experimental treatments. And generally, we make some assumptions in interpreting that data. So I think we assume that the abundance of enzymes that degrade carbon-rich substrates reflects the abundance of those particular substrates. The abundance of enzymes that degrade phosphorus or nitrogen-rich compounds might reflect the stoichiometric demand for those nutrients. And the other assumption is that the enzyme potentials that we measure in the lab are reflecting something about potential in situ activity, so something about what's actually going on in that environment. So today I'm gonna tell you three short stories, one anecdote, and give you a glimpse of the future. The three stories are, first, I'm gonna tell you about seasonal changes in situ activities in Arctic tundra soils. The second story is from a semi-arid grassland in Colorado, and I'll tell you about some short-term enzyme dynamics following a moisture pulse. The third story is from Boston, a climate change experiment in Boston, where we're looking at the responses of enzyme activities to drought, to experimental drought. Finally, I'll give you a little anecdote about tannin enzyme interactions, and then talk about emerging approaches and tools that are going to help us address some of these long-standing questions. Okay, so the first story comes from Alaska at Tulik Lake, where we have Arctic tundra vegetation. And basically, we wanted to see how the extracellular enzyme activity changes seasonally, because we know that the microbial communities that are active at different times of the year are changing, and we think they're using different substrates. So we want to understand the role of enzymes in that system. So we took the standard kind of approach of measuring enzyme activities at different points through time, different seasons. We found, and I'm just going to show you beta-glucosidase activity, but we found some seasonal patterns. We found that beta-glucosidase activity was highest in May and declined through the summer. What's interesting about that is that the enzyme activity was highest while the soils were still frozen. So it suggests that the microbes may have been producing those enzymes in the winter, and that they became more degraded through the summer. We also measured the temperature sensitivity of those enzymes, or here I'm plotting it as the Q10. And we found that the temperature sensitivity of enzymes changed seasonally as well. So it was highest in the winter and declined during the summer. We think what's happening is that different microorganisms are producing different isoenzymes, so different forms of the same type of enzyme that have a different structure and therefore a different temperature sensitivity. It could also have to do with what proportion of that enzyme pool is stabilized, and that might affect the temperature sensitivity as well. So we took that data and extrapolated it using actual field soil temperature data and modeled in situ potential enzyme activities for beta-glucosidase. What's interesting is that, remember that the enzyme activity assay told us that the highest potential activity was in May. But when we actually look at in situ activities, May is a time of very low in situ activity because the temperatures are very low. So when we factor in the temperature sensitivity of those enzymes, there's probably not a lot of enzyme activity in those soils at that time. And in fact, they peak for the tussocks in roughly July and the shrubs later in August. So the patterns in modeled in situ activity are very different from the patterns that we see if we just look at potential activities in the lab. We also, this is kind of anecdotal, but we found that overall the temperature sensitivity of enzymes that degrade carbon-rich substrates was higher than enzymes that degrade nitrogen-rich substrates. So if you think about that, that would suggest that with just an increase in temperature, we'd have a change in the types of substrates that are being degraded relative to each other. And this could lead to nitrogen limitation during the summer, which is what we do see in this environment. So I think that tells you that there's something that the fundamental aspects of the enzymes themselves, so different temperature sensitivities, could have an important role in determining carbon and nitrogen cycling in those systems, phosphorus cycling. So the more we learn about actually the sort of the biochemistry of these enzymes, it'll inform us about ecological processes as well. And temperature is one of those, just one of many aspects of the biochemistry of the enzyme that could be important for the ecology of the systems. So I want to encourage more labs to measure the temperature sensitivity of enzymes. Okay, so the second story is from Colorado, the semi-arid grassland. And here, this is a very pulse-driven system. So it's dry a lot of the time, and then we see rainfall events, which are a pretty big moisture pulse. We did a big experiment where we experimentally pulsed a bunch of plots, and we measured a bunch of things. One of the things we measured was enzyme activities. And this is just the results of the moisture pulse on soil water content. So we had two different levels. We had a 2-centimeter event and a 1-centimeter event. And you can see the moisture relative to the control. Well, this is what it looked like. So we measured a bunch of enzyme activities. I'm just showing four representative ones here on a daily time scale. And I don't know about you. I'd never measured enzyme activities on a daily time scale. Usually we measure seasonally. I thought this was scary because it suggests, and even if you just look at the control soils, which are shown here in blue, they're changing 100% each day. I mean, they're varying quite a bit. So of course, as soon as I saw this graph, I thought, well, it must be some kind of lab error. You know, my lab must have screwed up. But I went through the data really carefully, and we even repeated some of the samples, and we found the same thing. So I'm fairly confident that this is real. But to me, this is really scary because it suggests that when we take seasonal, when we just collect seasonally and do one date every couple months, we're getting a snapshot of something that could be really variable. And I don't know if this system is particularly variable. It could be. but something to keep in mind that when we just measure periodically, we don't really know what we're capturing. Now, to simplify, I'll just show you the results of the experiment by plotting each treatment relative to the control, so you can just see the effect of the moisture pulse. So there were some moisture pulse effects, like beta-glucosidase seemed to go up a little bit on day 2. If you look at leucine aminopeptidase, it seemed to peak on day 4, and phosphatase on day 2. So what's interesting to me is that these different enzymes are being produced at different time points following the pulse. So there's some kind of temporal dynamic. Everything doesn't sort of ramp up. All enzymes don't get produced at the same time. There could be stoichiometric constraints that sort of there's a succession of nutrient limitation after a pulse event. So the moral of story number 2 is that enzyme activities may be a lot more dynamic than we commonly assume, and that not only are they more dynamic, but they could differ for each particular enzyme that we're interested in. All right, so the third story comes from a climate change experiment in Boston. So at this experiment, there are 3 levels of precipitation, -50% ambient and +50%. And then 4 levels of warming. I'm just going to show you enzyme activities for 2 time points. So this first one is from August 2008. This is just a couple months after the warming had just been turned on. And so here we're ignoring the warming effect and just looking at the precipitation effect. Not surprisingly, it looks like the plots that received additional water, there's a little bit higher enzyme activity. That might not be too surprising. But when we looked in January of 2009, so the soils were frozen at this point, we found that the enzyme activities were highest in the drought soils. And this was really surprising. So here in January 2009, something's going on in the drought soils that's causing higher enzyme activity. Well, it's not higher microbial biomass. Microbial biomass was a bit lower in the drought plots. So it can't be explained by just higher microbial biomass. What we think is happening is that because the soils are dry, the enzymes are degrading at a much slower rate. So they're still being produced, but they're not being broken. They're not turning over as quickly. So we end up with a larger enzyme pool. And if you think back to the biogeochemistry model that I showed you earlier, I mentioned that the implicit assumption there is that the enzymes are probably in equilibrium with microbial biomass. Well, here's an example where they're clearly not. Clearly, for some reason in the drought plots, the enzymes are higher even though the microbial biomass is lower. So we're trying to figure out if indeed that's due to lower microbial or lower enzyme turnover using some proteomic approaches. So the moral of story number three is that enzyme turnover is a really important control on enzyme pools. And remember that when we're measuring enzyme activities, we're essentially measuring a pool of enzymes. So what affects a pool? Production and degradation, so the turnover. So it's really important to remember what we're actually measuring there and use caution when interpreting enzyme activities. So the anecdote that I mentioned. Every now and again, people get interested in the effects of tannins on ecosystems, and there's a session here devoted to that topic. So that's exciting to see. Well, I got interested in this topic myself, and in part because we're doing some work with soil proteins. We're trying to extract pure proteins from soils, and the tannins are just a pain. So that got me thinking about what they're actually doing in these systems. So we collected some preliminary data. This graph is just showing the effect of increasing concentrations of Artemisia tannins on enzyme activity. So this is just a lab assay where we added the tannins. You'll notice that the slope of that effect is much different for these two different enzymes. So the effect was relatively small on beta-glucosidase, but relatively large on phosphatase. So again, this suggests that with increasing tannin concentrations, the phosphatase enzymes are not going to work nearly as well as the beta-glucosidase activities. So the microbes are either going to have to produce more phosphatase activities or phosphorus might become limiting. Okay, so finally I want to talk about some emerging techniques and approaches that are going to be really useful in addressing some of these fundamental questions in enzymology. So first I'll talk about in situ measurements. Second, proteomics, and finally, modeling. So this paper by Dong is one where they used an approach to look at the spatial distribution of enzyme activities in soils. Essentially, they had a root window, so a plexiglass window exposing roots, and they used a membrane infused with a substrate on it. So they were able to look to demonstrate in figure A that phosphatase was closely associated with roots spatially. And they also looked at some other enzymes. So I think this was kind of a neat tool to look at the spatial distribution of enzymes. And it's a creative approach to try to understand what's going on in situ rather than in slurries. Another really useful tool that's just starting to emerge is proteomics. So proteomics is analogous to genomics. We're trying to understand the genetic information encoded in proteins by looking at their amino acid sequence or using information about their molecular mass to try to match it up to a database. There's lots of different aspects to proteomics. This is just a two-dimensional gel, and it was stained with a fluorescent substrate for beta-glucosidase. So in this case, in this paper, they used that technique to try to identify those beta-glucosidases. With proteomics, once you can identify them in a gel or through any other separation method, then you can use mass spectrometry and even what's called de novo sequencing to obtain the amino acid sequence. Once you obtain the amino acid sequence, you can use the genomic database to get information about who's producing it or if you don't know Well, yeah. So there, you can use kind of the whole genomic informatics pipeline to get more information out of it. And finally, modeling. So I think there's a lot of progress, and many different groups are working on trying to incorporate enzymes explicitly into biogeochemical models. This is an example that something I've been working on with Steve Allison and Mark Bradford, building on some earlier work by Schimmel and Weintraub, where they directly incorporated enzymes into the model. And what's interesting is we've been comparing that to models that don't implicitly include enzymes, and we get much different dynamics. So, you know, we can test in these models the effect of including enzymes and what the role of enzymes actually is, in especially in when under environmental change. So, to conclude, I think that through creative approaches and using novel techniques, we can test a lot of the assumptions that we currently have and have to make about enzymes, and we'll be able to better interpret the patterns that we see in enzyme activities. Through that, we'll really be able to develop sort of an integrated understanding of how abiotic drivers affect biological responses and how, in turn, plants and microbes change their enzyme production and how that affects biogeochemical processes in soils. So I think as we learn more about the biochemistry of enzymes, the controls on them, abiotic effects on enzymes, that we'll have a lot more to say about it, and we'll be able to quantitatively include them in biogeochemical models and improve our ability to predict the links between biological physiology, community composition with changes in the environment. So finally, I just want to plug the Enzymes in the Environment Research Coordination Network, funded by NSF, something I run with Richard Dick and Mary Stromberger. We're in our first year, so we're kind of just getting started. But if you check out our website, we have a lot of different activities, opportunities for training and research exchanges and several workshops coming up. So please check that out, and there'll be a poster on Wednesday. Thanks. Are there any questions? Adrian.
The slide where you showed the tan precipitation of phosphatase activities, you showed up to, I think, 100 milligrams per gram tan in addition to that slide. Are the concentrations in the soil that high?
No. I couldn't tell you exactly what they were, but I know we covered the range. We went beyond the range that we expected to see. Right.
So we're way inside that distribution under that concentration range.
There's a pretty small effect. Yeah, yes. True. Yeah.
You mentioned a few assumptions that people make about enzyme activity in the soil. One of the assumptions which you seem to make, I wonder if you might comment on, is that activity or turnover of substrates in soil is always limited by enzyme activity.
So the turnover would be limited by substrate availability, or the activity?
Yeah, so I mean, just in general, you mentioned that where activity is higher, it seems to me that you assume that the production of or the turnover of substrate will then automatically be higher as well. That's always the case, or in some cases, turnover or production of products might be limited by the availability of substrate.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And it's another important point is that in most of our assays, we're adding unlimited amounts of substrate. Of course, in soils, the rate of the reaction is going to be controlled by the substrate. So I think measuring the substrate availability, especially getting an idea of the spatial scale of enzyme substrate interactions, is really important. I'm not sure I meant to say that about enzyme turnover. I don't know if I'd agree necessarily, but I don't know.
So. Yeah, I meant more in terms of, for example, in the Arctic, where you mentioned that activity might be higher at certain times of year, but the production of substrate, or availability of substrate, might not necessarily be.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess the only correlation would be protease activity would also follow roughly.
Yeah.
the other ones.
Else, yeah, I think maybe we'll hold on the question. One more.
Okay.
Marianne has one.
One more question.
Yeah.
Okay. What about sorption interactions and possibly the interactions between enzymes and minerals? Can you comment on that?
Yeah, and I originally had that in there. I had to cut it, but I think that so enzyme mineral interactions are also really important. We don't know, again, how much activity is maintained by those complexes, and we don't know a lot about what controls the sorption desorption rates. So that's another aspect of enzymology that we really need to make progress on. Thanks.
Well, I didn't realize actually we have plenty of time because we scheduled your talk for 30 minutes.
Right.
So we have plenty of time to ask more questions. Any more questions?
Yeah, Jeannie?
Do you notice any specific patterns that will help you in your modeling, or are you just saying that someday we may be able to?
Can you guys hear in the back? Can you hear the questions? So she asked, essentially, after seeing the temporal dynamics of these enzymes, how can we utilize that data in our models? And basically, I'd suggest that we ignore that data and forget you ever saw it, because I don't know. That's a great question. I mean, I think we need to see if that's an exception, or if other systems are that dynamic. If they are, I have no idea how to deal with that. We need in situ sensors, I think.
Can I add one question related to that variability? Depending on how the samples are taken, I don't know if spatial variability is taken into consideration. Because that
day-to-day
variation, that's tremendous.
Sure, yeah.
So is spatial variability.
Yeah.
Tremendous, so.
A follow-up question there. Do you know what the seasonal differences are in enzyme activity? You saw that the daily.
Right. I don't, at that particular site, I don't know. We haven't measured it across seasons yet. I don't think anyone else has. Well, so that was based on a lab incubation. So we're, yeah. But I don't know. I think we kind of, you know, I can imagine some creative approaches, like they use ion probes in soils to collect nutrients over a period of time. Maybe we can come up with some kind of enzyme probe. I mean, I think that's kind of things we need to be thinking about. Don't necessarily require great leaps in technology, but some creative thinking. I think if this really is a problem, the day-to-day variation in other systems, then it's something we need to think about how to address. And I don't really have an answer.
Very good. No more questions.
Uh-oh. Yeah, that's a great question, and I need to do that calculation. So Elder asked, given that day-to-day variability, can we do a calculation on how much microbial activity, how much carbon and nitrogen would be required to produce, to give us that large daily fluctuation? It would probably be a lot. I should do that calculation. That's a good idea. Probably it'll tell us it's impossible, so I don't know what to make of it then. Right. Right.
He sits next to me. We'll have to fight this one out.
Okay, we can. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great talk.